good looking, but you sure can strut. Do them, baby. That's your thing, I see. You got something down there, woman. It's curving the hell out of me. The monkey and the baboon playing in the grass. The monkey stuck his finger in the baboon's ice cream. Do them, baby. Let your daddy see. You got something down there, woman.
Do you worry about how much someone drinks?
Do you feel angry or depressed most of the time? Do you feel neglected or unloved?
Do you feel that if the drinker loved you, she or he would stop drinking?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, you are not alone.
Not everyone trapped by alcohol is an alcoholic.
Families and friends are suffering too.
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Call 1-866-200-0223 or visit alanon.org/help.
I want to get close to me, baby. I just want you to get close to me, baby. Get close to me, baby. I want you to be close to me all the time. I want you to be so close to me till I can feel the blood running warm down my spine. I want to be close to me, baby. It's white on rice. I want to get close to me, baby. It's spots on the dice. I want to get close. Chinese twins, I want to get close to me, baby. Just like you can. I want you to be so close all the time until the blood run warm down my spine. I want to be close, close to me like white on rice. Close to my little girl like the spots on dice. I want to be close to my little girl. It's at your hand. I want to be so close to me. We look like Chinese twins. I want to be so close all the time until I can feel the blood running warm down my spine. Lord. Blood running down my spine. I want you to be so close to me, little girl. I can smell the white from the sheet. So close to me, little girl. Just like hair on a sheet. I want you to be close to me, little girl. I want you to be close to me all the time. I want you to be so close to me till I can feel it. Blood running warm down my spine.
Strong in a world where they don't get along.
When you're bitter,
and men don't cry. Men don't cry. People don't seem to care. In a world they just don't want to share. And men don't cry. Men don't cry.
It's Grant Lee Phillips telling you, if you're wondering where you're tuned to, it happens to be 88.3 FM, radio's finest, WRCT, Pittsburgh.
So we're going to start today with this incredible interview that took place with the now acquitted Kyle Rittenhouse on the Fox News Channel's Tucker Carlson program. This was a much promoted interview, and it confirms every single one of our suspicions about how Kyle Rittenhouse would be treated after his acquittal, which is they're making a hero out of him, or at least they're trying to. And as you watch these clips, consider the types of issues on which this 18-year-old kid who killed two people when he was 17 is being not only asked to weigh in, but Tucker's reactions, a full-grown man, reacting as if this is who we should be asking about such issues as the FBI, prosecutorial misconduct, self-defense, and on and on and on. So this is not only the exact predictable attempt to make a hero out of Kyle Rittenhouse that we predicted, but it is actually making him to be even more than that. It's making him an authority on self-defense. It's making him so many more things. So let's just jump right into it. Tucker Carlson introducing this and saying, this is the type of person you want more of in your country, if you can imagine that.
During the course of our long conversation, Kyle Rittenhouse struck us as bright, decent, sincere, dutiful, and hardworking. Exactly the kind of person you'd want many more of in your country. He's not especially political. He never wanted to be the symbol of anything.
So even just starting this with, this is just a great guy. I'm Tucker, and you trust me, and I tell you all the time what we need in this country. And we need more Kyle Rittenhouses. That's how they set the stage. And then immediately, you have Kyle Rittenhouse saying, this was about self-defense. This trial was about self-defense big picture, which the right loves. He's their hero.
It wasn't Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Wisconsin. It was the right to self-defense on trial.
Right.
And if I was convicted, no one would ever be privileged to defend their life against attackers.
Now, what Kyle Rittenhouse wants you to believe, and what others want you to believe, is that if in this particular case there had been a conviction, and again, it could have been a conviction just on one of the counts, it could have been, well, with the Rosenbaum killing, it wasn't self-defense. But maybe with Anthony Huber, it was, which my instinct was if there was going to be any guilty verdict, it would have been Rittenhouse and it would have been Rosenbaum and not Huber. But that's neither here nor there. He wants you to believe any guilty verdict here would mean people can't defend themselves anymore. However, that's an extremely myopic view of the facts, which include his choice to go there and his choice to go to provide medical help, supposedly, but with a gun and on and on. This is not about adjudicating the trial, but it's the idea that, what does this 18-year-old know about self-defense? He got himself into an insane situation, got away with killing two people under the guise of self-defense, but now we're going to him for advice about self-defense and what this means? It's crazy. Of course, at a certain point, you've got to bring up God, and he believes he had God on his side.
You know, you just got acquitted.
Yeah.
I mean, like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing I noticed, that you seem very calm. You don't seem like someone who's just been through a... you know, had his mind blown.
Yeah, on the inside, I'm freaking out, but the best thing you can do, you freak out, everybody else freaks out. It's like a chain reaction.
Yes.
So the best thing I can do is stay calm.
Do you feel like you've been watched over?
I believe God's been on my side through the beginning.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, what an amazing perspective that Tucker is eliciting here, right? And the entire interview was essentially like this, and what's very interesting is it really illuminates the difference between a propaganda interview and a real interview, because now we're going to look at an example of when Rittenhouse is allowed to get away with something with Tucker that he never would have been able to get away with in court. He says, you know, after I did shoot Joseph Rosenbaum, I was going to render first aid, when in the trial, through cross-examination, it was clear that that was not the case.
Well, he had shot. You decide at that point, and listen, misremembering, you want to go turn yourself into the police.
Yes. After I shoot Mr. Rosenbaum, he tried to grab my gun. I was running away. There was a gunshot behind me. After I shoot him, I run around the car because I was going to go render first aid to him.
Even this, I mean, this story is not the story that came out in the trial. Rosenbaum grabbed my gun in order to take it from Kyle Rittenhouse. That's a detail that was left unclear from the case. I'm not saying was or wasn't self-defense. Again, I as I said from the beginning, I think the facts lend themselves to a reasonable doubt that this was self-defense as Kyle Rittenhouse saw it. But this story, he tried to grab my gun and I still ran around the car to try to give him first aid after the first shot. That's not really what the video appears to show, but in a propaganda interview, you're allowed to get away with it.
I wasn't able to because then there was a mob forming and calling for my execution to get him and to kill him.
And of course, what's in between that Kyle Rittenhouse doesn't mention are the three further shots to Rosenbaum after Rosenbaum was already seemingly disabled. So it's not about relitigating the case. It's about understanding that this is a propaganda interview where he's allowed to give any version of events, even versions of events not backed up by the exhibits presented in the trial and that conflict with what came out in the trial. Okay, let's look at another clip here.
This case has nothing to do with race. It never had anything to do with race. It had to do with the right to self-defense.
Right.
I'm not a racist person. I support the BLM movement. I support peacefully demonstrating. And I believe there needs to be change. I believe there's a lot of prosecutorial misconduct, not just in my case, but in other cases. And it's just amazing to see how much a prosecutor can take advantage of somebody.
So once again, this is another one of those examples of 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse on prosecutorial misconduct. They're making him an authority. They're making him a hero. They're making him a poster child, when just because you were accused of a crime doesn't mean you know anything about supposed prosecutorial misconduct. And he knows and people are commenting, oh, he supports BLM. Okay. Maybe we have no idea what that means. Maybe he does. I'm not denying that he does. It might just mean he supports BLM insofar as they have a right to be heard at protests. It could mean, it doesn't really matter here, but he's learning the talking points. And in this next clip, you're going to see him do the FBI stuff, which is, remember, among the right now, you have to criticize the FBI. And he says, I don't know if they're going to be able to keep me safe. You know how the FBI works, which this is classic red meat to those who know what to listen for.
Ignorant to look at the facts of what happened.
Do you feel the threats?
I do. I see some of the threats. Some of the things people say, it's absolutely sickening.
Are you confident that the government will protect you from these threats? Because that's, of course, the government's job.
I hope so, but we all know how the FBI works.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, it's been, you know.
Okay. So he knows the talking points. He knows it. We got to be very skeptical and critical of the FBI. That's something that grew significantly under Trump. And that has become sort of a standard calling card now of right-wing media. So he's got that one. He learned that one for sure. The topic of Joe Biden came up, and Kyle Rittenhouse even given the opportunity to send a message directly to President Joe Biden.
Besides, like my case.
What did you make of the President of the United States calling you a white supremacist?
Mr. President, if I could say one thing to you, I would urge you to go back and watch the trial and understand the facts before you make a statement.
That's not a small thing to be called that.
No, it's actual malice, defaming my character, for him to say something like that.
Defaming, defamation. We're going to come back to that because that actually comes up again. Now, in the midst of this, you might remember that all sorts of shady characters got wrapped up with Kyle Rittenhouse early on. One of them is Lynn Wood, this sort of Trump-affiliated wacky attorney who's made all sorts of insane claims about COVID, as well as about the 2020 elections. And this is sort of a departure from what we've been talking about. Kyle Rittenhouse talks about how he believes he was taken advantage of by some of these lawyers who were raising money for themselves, and he was kept in jail. And this is just a crazy aspect to this.
How long were you there?
I was in jail for 87 days, and this goes as follows in with Lynn Wood, who Lynn Wood was raising money on my behalf, and he held me in jail for 87 days, disrespected my wishes, put me on media interviews, which I should never have done, which he said, oh, you're going to go talk to the Washington Post, which was not a good idea, along with John Pierce. They said I was safer in jail instead of at home with my family. And then after I'm bailed.
Your lawyer said that.
My lawyer said that. John Pierce and Lynn Wood.
87 days is a long time to be in jail.
It was very long. I lost a lot of weight in there. I since then gained it back.
I know the feeling.
Yeah.
So this is crazy. This is a propaganda interview, but it also shows you that these sort of predatory figures like Lynn Wood, they're everywhere, and there's no opportunity that they won't take advantage of. And here Rittenhouse talks about how he was treated in jail. Now there's two sides to this part. Let's listen.
But I didn't have running water.
Seriously?
I had a phone also, but I did not have running water, so I didn't shower until November 20th.
How long
From
is
October
that?
31st to November 20th, I did not take a shower.
That's disgusting.
I smelled terrible. I felt sick. I lost weight. My health was degrading.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this one is this has happened in the context of the January 6th riots as well, where, you know, we on the left have been sounding the alarm about jail and prison conditions, pretrial detention, etc., for more than a decade on this program. And the right has not cared about it until it affects them. And so now you've heard everybody from Marjorie Taylor Greene to who knows who on the right complain about the alleged conditions in which the alleged January 6th Trump rioters have been held. And now jail conditions all of a sudden are a big deal to them. And similarly, now all of a sudden with the Rittenhouse stuff, that issue is now they care about that issue. Now, it's actually an important issue, but it's again the brazen nature by which they only care about it when it affects them. There have been questions, is Kyle Rittenhouse going to sue media outlets for things they said about him? Various legal opinions about whether that would go anywhere, but Kyle Rittenhouse sort of using coded language to say, yeah, we may do that.
And they would like to see you, you know, help make this better by holding some of these liars to account. Do you plan to do that?
I have really good lawyers who are taking care of that right now. So I'm hoping one day there will be accountability for their actions that they did.
Okay, so you're intent on not, you're not going to let that go.
Like I said.
So suggesting there that there may well be defamation suits coming, and where those will go, we have absolutely no idea, but it's looking like this is going to be a very litigious year or two for Kyle Rittenhouse. And then lastly, Kyle Rittenhouse, the lionization and the heroism continues with Kyle talking about what kind of a career he wants to pursue.
What do you think your life's going to be like after this?
I'm hoping I can live a quiet, stress-free life and be free of any intimidation or harassment and just go on with my life as a normal 18-year-old kid attending college.
So you're going to go to college?
I am in college. I'm a student at Arizona State University.
Now, in the trial, it seems like that was not true unless something has changed, but that's really neither here nor there.
What I mean, are you going to go to campus? And
I think I am. I want to. It's a lot of things we have to look into, so I don't know for sure yet. but I do intend on going in campus and pursuing a career in nursing. I may change it. I've been looking into law. I may want to become a lawyer. I haven't completely decided yet. But I've been looking, I want to be a nurse, so I've been doing the prerequisites for.
How nice, right? So exactly as predicted, this is the new hero. This is the new hero. And of course, you can judge for yourselves based on your values and how you see the world, whether you think that he's worthy of being designated this hero. But weighing in on everything from prosecutorial misconduct to the trustworthiness of the FBI on the basis of the fact that he killed two people and was acquitted for it, exactly as we predicted. On December 14th, we will be doing our next David Pakman Show viewer town hall. It will be on the Pakman Live YouTube channel. Make sure you're subscribed to that channel at youtube.com/PakmanLive. We're going to take a quick break and be back right after this. So we've been talking about the authoritarian slide of the United States over the last many years, which goes beyond Donald Trump. It accelerated under Donald Trump, but it actually goes beyond Donald Trump. And now for the first time ever, the United States has actually been listed as a backsliding democracy. This has never happened before. The Guardian has a very interesting article about it. U.S. added to list of backsliding democracies for the first time. Visible deterioration in U.S. civil liberties began in at least 2019, says International Think Tank. This is the International Idea Think Tank. Globally, more than one in four people live in a backsliding democracy, a proportion that rises to more than two in three when you include authoritarian or hybrid regimes, according to the Stockholm-based International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. This year, we coded the United States as backsliding for the first time, but our data suggests the backsliding episode began at least in 2019. The United States is a high-performing democracy and even improved its performance in indicators of impartial administration, corruption, and predictable enforcement in 2020. However, the declines in civil liberties and checks on government indicate that there are serious problems with the fundamentals of democracy. A historic turning point came in 2021 when former President Trump questioned the legitimacy of the 2020 election results. Hudson pointed to a decline in the quality of freedom of association and assembly during the summer of protests in 2020 after the police killing of George Floyd. International Idea based its assessments on 50 years of democratic indicators in 160 countries. There are three categories for democracies, including those that are backsliding, hybrid governments, and authoritarian regimes. Another word for a backsliding democracy is creeping authoritarianism or autocratization, democratic decay, de-democratization, a gradual decline in the quality of democracy, the opposite of democratization. If unchecked, democratic backsliding results in the state losing its democratic qualities, becoming an autocracy or an authoritarian regime. Now, there's another aspect to this. The other aspect to this is that when you talk about authoritarianism and you talk about people like Donald Trump, it is not just about what they would like to see implemented. There's this other aspect we've talked about, which Princeton has studied, which is whose goals are more likely to be made policy. And in that sense, the U.S. hasn't really been a representative democracy for a long time, wherein the policy goals of the rich and of big corporations are far more likely to be made law than those of the average person. I mean, you know, you look at things like the estate tax. The estate tax in which an individual has an $11 million exemption and a couple has $22 million in exempt money that they can pass to heirs, tax-exempt money. That benefits a very small portion of people, and yet it has been a mainstay in some form or another, to some degree or another, for a long time. And we talk about so many other rules that benefit large corporations. That's been a concern for a long time. And then now, in addition, you have this. Now, one last thing I do want to mention about this. There's another aspect to this, which is there is the belief from some on the right that aside from freedom rankings and all these different things, that there are great things in the U.S. Like, for example, the U.S. is just the best place to be doing business, to have a business, to be an entrepreneur. That's also not true. And it's important when we talk about pros and cons. Every place has pros and cons. And when we look at something like, oh, no, now the U.S. is officially a backsliding democracy, when they say, yeah, but it's like the best place to do business, that's also not true. And as one example, if you look at the Open for Business rankings and you actually look at what are the places, you see that it's Switzerland number one, Panama number two, Canada number three, Canada, Denmark number four, Sweden, places that the right often likes to say are nanny state, pseudo-socialist places, rank higher for business environment than the United States. New Zealand, Norway, Ireland, many originally U.S.-based businesses, moving operations or partially moving operations to Ireland. You have Finland, Netherlands, Malaysia, Australia, Belgium. It's a very, very long list before you ultimately get to the United States, which I can't even find at this point because it is quite far down the list. Latvia, Croatia, and of course, this has to do with everything from regulation to amount of paperwork and the United States ranking 45th in the Open for Business rankings, exactly the same as 2020. So the important thing here is when they say, well, you might point out this part that's not so good, but this other one is really good, actually go and look it up because it's not always the case. And of course, if you believe in openness, democracy, anti-authoritarianism, as I do, you don't want to see the U.S. listed as a backsliding democracy for the first time. But alas, that's where we are. And this goes beyond just who's president. This has a lot to do with many different aspects, including surveillance, including corruption, including so many different things, not going in the right direction. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back after this. Making his triumphant return today, defiant and triumphant, I would say, to the David Pakman Show, is Andrew Yang, entrepreneur turned politician, author of the new book Forward, Notes on the Future of Our Democracy, which I was glad to take a look at a couple weeks ago when you sent it to me. Former Democratic presidential primary candidate, former New York City mayoral candidate. I mean, there's just so much to talk about, but it's great having you back on.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here. It's been so long, been far too long.
It has. So, you know, you and I, we have many things in common and many things not in common. One of the things we have in common is we are pragmatists.
We both run for president, David. Is that what happened?
I can't. I'm a naturalized citizen, so I cannot do it. That is something I unless the law changes, I will never be able to do, sadly. But in our pragmatism, I think we both prioritize solving problems. And that comes through in the book. It came through in your presidential campaign, et cetera. To solve problems, we've got to figure out what created the problem. So to what do you attribute the current division that exists politically in the United States?
In a word, David, incentives. But one of the things I found in researching and writing my book was that this is not normal. We are not in normal times. If you rewind a number of decades, well, if you go way back to the founding of the country, then they're not fans of political parties. The Republican Party comes about in the wake of the Civil War, starts out as the Northern Anti-Slavery Party. But the two parties, despite trading power back and forth for about 100 years, were kind of indistinguishable ideologically until the 1960s reorganizes things somewhat with the Civil Rights Movement. And then you have the end of the Fairness Doctrine, the beginning of cable TV in the 90s. And so the two parties have started diverging ideologically and politically really over the last 30, 40 years or so. And that's given rise to the urban-rural divide, the educated, less educated divide. But all of the political incentives now are around the extremes because 83% plus of the congressional races are decided in the primary. So in each party, in order to get reelected, you just want to not get primaried, which means you're going to be trying to keep people off your back in the extreme flank of your party. See this very clearly with the Republicans, where if someone says a bad word about Trump, they then get attacked and cast out. So you have these political incentives around the extremes, and then you have media incentives compounding those extremes by separating us into ideological armed camps at this point. And then you have social media on top of it, So this is why we feel like we're careening towards political violence and worse. And I just want to commend folks like you, because I do see independent media as the antidote. Like, you all aren't as ideological or inflammatory in many cases. Of course, there are people that are like that, but not you, David. So the polarization we're feeling is now a very predictable result of all of the political and media incentives that are driving the system.
Okay. I mostly, small issues I could take with that, but for our discussion today, basically agree with the assessment. So we then get to the forward movement, the forward party, bridging this gap, finding something that maybe can cross the traditional party lines that more people can agree with. First question is, what is it that you think would be appealing to people from these two sometimes ideological extremes, sometimes just ideological differences?
Well, I would say that polarization is a bad thing for everyone. Let's say you're on the left and you'd like to get something done on climate change. And you look up and you're like, why can we not get anything done on climate change? A Republican senator said something to me that really hit home. She said, Andrew, we get rewarded more for keeping an issue around than resolving it. And the example I've been using is Marco Rubio suggesting immigration reform, and then he gets shivved by the Republican Party. He's like, never mind, nothing to see. So if you are on the left and you're like, why can't we do things that 60, 70, 75% of us want, then you'd want to try and reform this system to become more rational and more responsive to the desire of the majority of us. And you could go down the list on issues. You go immigration, you go climate change.
Well, let's take climate change. I mean, so I think this is where we might have our first disagreement. Completely agree with you that the system, by explicitly and implicitly, with things like the term limits that we have, almost always having to be campaigning for your next election, all these different things don't prioritize solutions to long-term problems like climate change. I agree with everything you've said. And yet, part of climate change is a huge portion of one side doesn't believe it's real, or if they do, they don't believe humans are a factor. So this is where I get to, your analysis is great. I don't think it accounts for, it's more than that, when one side simply won't accept the science. How do you get those people to buy in?
All right, so let's play this out.
Yeah.
What proportion of Americans don't believe that climate change is real or caused by humans?
The last I've seen, I wish I had the data in front of me. I think it's about half or 60% of Republicans don't believe it's caused by humans, and maybe 25-33%, something like that, don't believe it's even happening at all.
Yeah, so that lines up with what I thought the numbers were roughly. So let's imagine that you have gross numbers. 35% of Americans who either don't think climate change is caused by humans or it's not a big deal or whatever it is. And that percentage is declining happily or unhappily because it's becoming so apparent around us.
Yeah.
So right now you have a Republican Party that is motivated by that, let's call it for argument's sake, roughly half of the Republican Party or a bit more does not think climate change is something we should do anything about.
Sure.
The problem is that relative minority ends up controlling the agenda for half of the country and then can stall any real move to change it.
Yes.
So let's say hypothetically, instead of having two parties, we had four parties or five parties, and you had progressive Democrats, moderate Democrats, forwardists, moderate Republicans, and conservative Republicans. And the conservative Republicans would be like, hey, climate change, bunk, let's not do a thing. But then you'd have the four other groups look up and say, we should do something about it. So what you're seeing here is not quite minority rule, but it's minority veto, or it's minority keeping anything from happening. And so this is the system as it currently is made up. So the thing that I want people to come to grips with is that politics right now is completely tribal. And you can be very, very angry at what another tribe says or feels. But the problem right now is that we only have two tribes, and it doesn't take much to gum up the works, which is why we're all losing our minds, getting more polarized and frustrated.
Yeah. And so this gets us to really a discussion of third parties. And I'm curious, I have a view as to why third parties have not become more significant at the national level. I'm curious what your view is. My view is it's essentially two things. It's not for lack of want of more options. It's not for lack of political diversity. It's not because of the desire for more political diversity in the major parties. People want that. It's two things. One, that the side whose third party does best ultimately risks being a spoiler. And people who say, I'd like a third. This is the age old Green Party thing. I mean, this is not new, right? Oh, I like this. It probably gets the people I really don't want in power if it goes well. And number two, connected to that, how politics is financed in the United States as well. Those are, for me, the two main reasons. Why? What do you see?
In a word, incentives. So if you decide to break from the two major parties, all of a sudden you don't have capital structure, you don't have votes, you don't have media.
Yep.
And so you're in the wilderness. Now, I do want to return to the you're going to mess it up for whatever team you're closer to. Mm-hmm. This is one reason why the first big move the Forward Party is making is to push for ranked choice voting combined with open primaries, because if you had ranked choice voting in an election, you could vote Green 1, Democrat 2, Republican 3, and then no one needs to worry about it. The problem right now is that the duopoly wants to stifle any competition, and it uses fear. It's like if I had a buck for every time someone said, oh, you're going to mess it up for the Democrats, even though the numbers do not make it clear that that's exactly what I'd be doing. And I have said absolutely nothing about, a national race. Like, I'm trying to get things done at the local level for 22. But if you were to shift to ranked choice voting, then the spoiler effect disappears, which is exactly why we need it. And also exactly why the duopoly doesn't want to talk about it, because to your point, at this point, a majority of Americans want to move on from the duopoly. We know it's not working, but we just keep being told we can't have it because of this archaic voting system that we could change. If enough of us got together to say, look, let's just do everything by ranked choice voting, no more spoiler effect. But the parties don't want that, because the parties know that we actually don't like them very much. And that the only reason we're choosing A is because they're trying to scare us about B.
So the question then becomes, how do you, I mean, this is sort of like when an elected official says, as soon as I get in, I'm going to do voting, you know, election reform and campaign finance reform. It's like, hold on a second. You're going to come to power under the system we have and then change the system that worked to get you in power, it to go to incentives. It doesn't seem like you'll be super incentivized to do that. The same question sort of applies here. If we need to make the changes you're talking about to campaign finance and how votes are counted first past the post in order to make the third party more reasonable, more viable, how are we going to make those changes?
So the Forward Party has two major endeavors in 2022.
Okay.
Number one is that, and it turns out because the political parties are made up, that we could actually get together and change to an open primary ranked choice voting at the state level.
Yes.
In 24 states around the country, if just enough of us got together. And for people who think like, oh, this will never happen, it happened last year in one state, Alaska, 2020, changed from party primaries to open primaries and ranked choice voting. And you immediately saw the result when Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska voted to impeach Donald Trump, the only Republican senator to do so who's up for re-election in 2022. Her approval rating among Alaskan Republicans is now 6%. So it is genuinely politically suicidal for a Republican to go against Trump. But she can skip the party primary. It doesn't exist anymore. You have an open primary, so she can take her case to the entire Alaskan public and then say, look, like, I'm an independent person, bring me back. So if we make the same change that Alaska made in 3, 4, 5 states around the country in 2022, imagine 6, 8, 10 senators, some of them Republican, who are then free of the thrall of their party, free to do what they think is right. Maybe they'll even support protecting secretaries of state from election interference. This is something we can do if we had enough Americans get together and do what they did in Alaska. So that's step one, which we don't have to wait for anyone to do. We can do it right now if there are enough of us. So that's what the Forward Party is about, trying to gather that movement. The second thing is we can support candidates who are fighting on principle as Democrats, independents, or Republicans. And I'm just going to call out someone who I doubt people on your program talk much about. There is a West Virginia congressman named David McKinley who co-sponsored a cash relief bill that I lobbied for and voted yes on infrastructure. He's one of the 13 Republicans to do so. He's now facing a fight with a Trumper. And who the heck is going to help David McKinley? Like, the Democrats would be like, oh, he's a Republican, so screw it. You know, but I'm going to suggest that a lot of Americans should be getting behind David McKinley and some other reasonable Republicans who are endangered species because they're taking flack for doing the right thing.
So that's interesting. So you mentioned a Republican. Is there a prominent Democrat right now that people in my audience might know that you think is particularly suited and tailored for the milieu of the Forward Party, as you describe it?
I believe Elizabeth Warren came out as pro-ranked choice voting when it was up on the ballot in Massachusetts last year. So anyone who's for ranked choice voting, I'm excited about. And there are a number of prominent Democrats and democracy reformers who have taken that stance. I think Cory might have done so as well.
I'm really curious about the coalition that you envision to some degree. You know, when I told my audience that you were going to be on, the most frequent question I got in different iterations was, who exactly that currently considers themselves to be on the right does Andrew Yang imagine bringing into the Forward Party? And to kind of make it a little more specific, you know, we would imagine that there's lots of progressive Democrats, more centrist Democrats, even some folks who really consider themselves centrist, maybe in the kind of line of even like a John McCain, who like the idea of some of the reforms you're talking about. And that all kind of makes sense to me. When I think about people who believe Donald Trump won the election, vaccines, the COVID vaccine magnetizes you, causes autism, whatever the case may be, et cetera, right? You know the package of ideas that I'm talking about. One, are those people that would even conceivably say this Forward Party idea that Andrew Yang proposes in a coalition with the left makes sense? And number two, are these even people that you want as part of your coalition?
First, let me say, I want everyone as part of the coalition. You know, if you can vote, we can disagree on a lot of things. It's all to the good. If we agree on the fact that this duopoly is not working, it's designed to turn us against each other and sink us. So that's one of the principles of the Forward Party is that, look, I can disagree with you on a lot of stuff, but if we can make common cause on this, then we can go back to disagreeing when the democracy is actually set up to succeed, when they're, you know.
So let me ask. To make it really specific, if people on the right say the Republican Party is too centrist, I'm an extreme white supremacist or something like that, but I think we need to get, you know, we need single transferable vote or whatever and campaign. You still welcome that because you're on the same page on that one issue.
Yeah, if they're going to help us transition to a more effective democracy, I don't need to know what their stance is on things that I disagree with. People have a sense of where I'm coming from.
Okay.
But right now, I believe that there is an existential threat to the country as a result of the greatest design flaw in the history of the world. That is, and if you will help us resolve that design flaw, then we can have a discussion about anything else under the sun. Okay. At a time when the democracy actually will stand the test of time, when we transition to a multi-party system where you can't make any autocratic or authoritarian decisions, you have to somehow get two or three other parties on board.
Okay. All right. Fair. So on the question of is everyone literally welcome, the answer is yes. That's fine. That's legitimate. So that's clear. Now, in terms of to whom that currently typically votes for Republicans, would this appeal? Where are you on that?
There are all sorts of folks who are displeased with Trump. There's a person online who said the other day, it's like, look, I voted for Trump twice and I don't even want him back. there are voters out there who are concerned about the country. I've been heartened by the fact that I've gotten a lot of incoming expressions of support from military veterans, members of law enforcement or former law enforcement who despair about the state of the country. They see where it's going to and they say, this is what I've been waiting for. There's an independent community that right now is politically homeless. They're very numerous. There are 44% of Americans consider themselves independents. I would say that we're seeing a lot of them come in. Like, one of the things I'm going to suggest, first, if you look at the appetite for a third party, it's higher among both Republicans and independents than Democrats. So if you imagine who's going to draw third party energy, like, if, or where it's going to come from, like, by the numbers, it's likely to come from those groups. And imagining that every Republican or former Republican or independent is excited about Trump is just not right, you know. But saying that that group is also open to Democrats is also not right. I have encountered so many Americans who just shut down when you have a D next to your name,
sure,
which I found unfortunate. But the thing I want to suggest to people is that, again, all politics is tribal at this point. And so what we need to do is we need to have more tribes emerge so that we have a chance. If we stick to two tribes, we're done.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and we're shifting gears a little bit, but because of your background in technology, I'm very curious as to your insights, particularly as someone who used social media really effectively in the Democratic primary run that you made. All the talk now about the so-called regulation of social media. One interesting artifact of this has been the rapidity with which those who have for a long time claimed businesses should be able to do whatever they want as long as it's not illegal are now demanding that social media companies be forced to allow messages that violate their terms of service to be up. That's a hypocrisy we could talk about, but I don't want to focus on that necessarily today. What I'm curious about from your perspective is, what should be the regulatory infrastructure as to the social networks, particularly from this point of view of political bias that Don Jr., whoever else, are regularly tweeting about and sort of saying we are the victims here? What would you like to see?
I think our government needs to modernize its approach to social media and technology in general. Right now, it's behind the curve. It's laughable or embarrassing. This is also an outgrowth of our gerontocracy, David. I mean, the reality is that our congressional leaders are in their 70s or 80s. If it is Biden versus Trump in 24, which it looks like it's going in that direction, their combined age will be 158.
Yeah.
So then asking our government to understand what's going on in social media is, at least right now, a bridge too far, and like that has to change. If I were in charge, I would be getting into the guts of these social media companies, setting what Jonathan Haidt suggested as like a filter where you end up being able to just like ignore people who are customarily aggressive, obnoxious. I mean, you can watch it if you want or get those messages if you want, but you actually set up a way to reward people who tend to be more balanced and normal in their conversation.
Okay.
Because right now the energy in social media rewards the more aggressive or sensationalistic. You're self-accepted again. You just like keep it even keeled, and yet everyone loves you.
Well, you should see the emails I get. But so it sounds like you're not saying you would be in favor of the government going to YouTube and saying you've got to leave up anti-vaccine content.
Well, there are certain things that you'd have to say are in the public good and there's disinformation. And there's disinformation that can be destructive in a way that, you know, like if you were functioning society, you do not want to say like every idea is the same, including ideas that, by the way, in this case, could lead people to lose their lives.
So in other words, you want to make it easier to control one's experience on these platforms, but not take the approach that some on the right are saying, which is these platforms should be forced to allow content that violates their terms of service. Again, as long as it's not illegal on the basis of discrimination on race or sex or this type of thing.
Well, I'm going to echo what some of the social media CEOs themselves say, which is like, why are we in position to make this decision? And the reason they're making that decision is because the government is absent. One of the social media CEOs said, look, we should get together tech, government, media, nonprofits, and set rules of the road so it's not just us doing the content moderation decision, then you yelling at us about it. Because wherever they draw the line, they're going to get yelled at. You know, I happen to think the conservatives are off base in terms of saying like, oh, you know, you're sludging conservative content. It's like conservative content actually performs great on a lot of these platforms.
Yeah.
And if there's anything we should be concerned about, it's the deteriorating mental health of our young people, teenage girls in particular. So if you're a conservative, like, get mad about that in my mind.
Right.
Like, yeah. Your daughter's being depressed. Like, isn't that a bigger issue than the fact that, you know, anyway.
And I guess then the question would become, if Facebook knew that was going on and was hiding it for a period of time, are they really good faith players to be involved in figuring out the regulation, which is sort of a second order question?
Well, they can be at the table, but we should stop pretending that companies are going to do anything other than what's going to maximize their financial returns, which is exactly what you'd expect them to do. So so if you have that expectation and then you go in and say, hey, guess what? We're going to do things that are going to make your financial returns lower, and tough luck. You know, and so one thing I suggested as like a random thing, it's like maybe Instagram should turn off for teenagers between midnight and 7 a.m. Like, you know, maybe just looking at pictures of your high school classmates is something we don't want you to do in the middle of the night. You know, just like a random thought. And so you can see that kind of like, would Facebook be excited about that? Of course not. They'd be like, oh, we make money then. We make money all the time.
Right.
It's like, well, you know, like.
The book is Forward, Notes on the Future of Our Democracy. I really appreciate reading the book, and we've been speaking with the book's author, Andrew Yang. Always great having you on, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, David. Great to be back.
All right, we teased that this might happen, and it's happening. Beto O'Rourke, former Democratic presidential candidate, is running for governor in Texas against Republican incumbent Greg Abbott. I think, number one, this is great. This is exciting. It would be fantastic to remove Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott's approval ratings have been sinking and sinking and sinking in the context of his total humiliating, farcical mishandling of COVID. But can Beto O'Rourke actually win in Texas, particularly given some of the things he said about guns in the past? I hope the answer is yes, but I don't know. Beto O'Rourke held a gubernatorial campaign kickoff in Dallas, announced his candidacy Monday. Three Republicans are also running for the office. Now, the rally speech that he gave was good. You know, he's a good speaker, all considering. He's excites people to some degree. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Greg Abbott chose not to expand Medicaid, would not take yes for an answer from the federal government when they offered to pay 95 cents on the dollar for expanded health care in Texas. We are the least insured state in the country by a Texas mile. There are more who cannot see a doctor or fill a prescription, or take their child to a therapist than in any other state in the union. In this community, we still see people dying of diabetes 100 years after insulin was developed, which cost pennies to distribute. Still, some people in Dallas cannot afford to buy it and are dying of it. The common flu, curable cancers, these things are taking our moms, our dads, our grandparents.
So these are great talking points, but are they the right talking points for Texas? I don't know the answer. As 538 has written about, Texas voters have soured on Greg Abbott, but that doesn't mean they'll vote for Beto O'Rourke. Abbott is not as popular as he once was. His disapproval has now climbed close to 50. His approval is below 45. But the question that 538 asks is, what about voters in looking at Abbott versus Beto O'Rourke? And it looks okay for Beto O'Rourke, but he has similar dislike numbers to Greg Abbott, and he's only now starting to run for something. He's not the incumbent governor. That's potentially a red flag. The point in favor of Greg Abbott, quite frankly, is this horrible abortion law that's been passed in Texas. I'm sorry, the point in favor of Beto O'Rourke against Greg Abbott is the abortion law that's been passed in Texas, which we've discussed. That's certainly something that could mobilize voters. But I have real concerns because I imagine that this clip is going to be played on repeat. This was when Beto O'Rourke, during one of the Democratic presidential debates, was asked about firearms. And this is my advice, is always just don't even talk about firearms in campaigns, because it really just mobilizes Republicans to vote against you. But remember this.
Are you proposing taking away their guns, and how would this work?
I am. If it's a weapon that was designed to kill people on a battlefield.
Right. So that did well with a Democratic crowd. But as I've said before, that can really crush you in Texas. So I'm excited about this. It would be amazing to remove an incumbent Republican governor in Texas and replace him with a Democratic challenger. We're going to be following this race. We're going to be talking about it a lot, helping and hoping to inspire people to get mobilized there. I just don't know if Beto O'Rourke is actually the right candidate, and I'm not the only one who has this concern. So we are going to continue following that very closely. The legal problems for conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and for former Trump associate Roger Stone continue. And you might remember that on the one hand, Roger Stone was convicted and subsequently pardoned, but he has had his fair share of legal trouble. Alex Jones is in the middle of multiple lawsuits, including some related to his conspiracy theories and false claims of a false flag in the context of the Sandy Hook shooting back in 2012. And they both now have even more legal troubles. Alex Jones and Roger Stone have been subpoenaed by the House panel investigating the January 6th riots. The panel said it subpoenaed Trump spokesman Taylor Budowich, Republican political operative Roger Stone, and conspiracy monger Alex Jones, as well as two others, in a report by CNBC. The House panel says the new recipients who have been asked for testimony and documents are believed to have knowledge of the plans and funding for the rallies on January 6th. Now, we're going to see whether they actually respond to these subpoenas or whether they will end up being held in contempt. But these are clearly key figures, and there's a few different things to think about. Steve Bannon has also now been indicted for his ignoring of a subpoena from this committee. So a few different things. Number one, it really seems like Alex Jones is an important figure in the January 6th Trump riots. The day before the riots, there's a video that was posted to his website, Infowars.com, which shows him telling a crowd in Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., "We have only begun to resist the globalists," or globalists, as he says. "We have only begun to fight against tyranny. They have tried to steal this election in front of everyone. I don't know how this is all going to end," he said, "but if they want to fight, they better believe they've got one." That was the night before the January 6th riots. This guy seems to be up to his eyeballs involved in this thing. And he has now been subpoenaed. Roger Stone has now been subpoenaed. Trump spokesman Taylor Budowich has been subpoenaed. And of course, Stephen Bannon ignored his subpoena and has now been indicted for that. Will we ever really learn the full scope of the planning, the pre-planning that went on? I don't know if we will. I really don't. But it's pretty clear that these guys are up to their eyeballs in this stuff, and the January 6th committee should keep going and going and going. There may not be political consequences. In fact, unfortunately, I think there probably will not be. The elected officials who were involved are mostly in safe red districts, in safe red states, or not even up for re-election when it comes to senators in the immediate future. And they will most likely all get reelected, and there probably won't be legal consequences for them. But when it comes to people like Alex Jones, whoever they can get, they should pursue if that's where the evidence points. And that is absolutely where the evidence is pointing right now. So continued legal trouble for Alex Jones and others, and we'll see what comes of it. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. You can call absolutely anytime you want. Yesterday on the show, I sort of offhandedly made an analogy when it comes to asymmetric risk and a mathematical term called expected value. And I talked about a 10-sided die, and I incorrectly said the expected value would be 5. I got a number of polite voicemails and emails saying, "David, you got that wrong." Here is one of them.
"David, sir, I believe you made a mistake in your discussion of expected value on the show."
"Yes.
If you roll a 10-sided die and earn the amount of money that shows up on the die, such as $1 for a 1, $2 for a 2, et cetera, as you discussed, your expected value is actually $5.50, not just $5.
Yes.
Just try it. Add up all the numbers from 1 to 10 and divide by 10. It's $5.50. You'd need a 9-sided die for the expected value to be $5, which I'm not sure is geometrically possible. Anyways, I appreciate your attempt to incorporate statistics into the show, and keep up the good work."
Yeah, I received many corrections. The expected value of the imaginary 10-sided die is 550, not 5. The point I was trying to make still remains, but I appreciate being corrected, and I appreciate the audience for keeping me honest, but also accurate. And it is an expected value of 550. If you don't even know what I'm talking about, not a big deal. We have a great bonus show for you today. The Ahmaud Arbery killing, with three defendants in that trial, has moved beyond closing arguments and is, as we speak, in prosecution rebuttal. And we're going to talk about how this case differs from the Kyle Rittenhouse case on today's bonus show. We are also going to talk about this bizarre incident where a truck carrying cash had some kind of an issue where the cash ended up scattered all over a California freeway, and it caused quite a frenzy. We'll also talk about the difference between a freeway and a highway. I still don't understand it. Maybe there isn't one. We will also talk about the COVID spike that's going on. In some parts of the United States, things are as bad right now as they were last November. Why? And what is the outlook? We're going to talk about all of it on today's bonus show. You can sign up on my website, joinpacman.com. Become a member, get instant access to the bonus show. We will be here tomorrow with a new show and then off the rest of the week for Thanksgiving. But many programs still.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world and everyone everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT, 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT 883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct?
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, rocks.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona, but when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we're always here for you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Arr, I'm from Creationist Crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Hi, you're listening to
WRCT.
Pittsburgh. CMU.
This is Sue Garner.
And Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! A federal jury in Virginia has ordered a group of white supremacists to pay over $26 million in damages for their role in organizing the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. We'll get the latest and look at the trial in Georgia of the three white men who killed Ahmaud Arbery. Then to a disturbing story about rape near Buffalo, New York. A judge has sparked outrage after ruling it's inappropriate to jail a young serial rapist from a prominent family who pleaded guilty to raping and sexual assaulting four teenage girls aged 15 and 16. We'll speak to one survivor who was in the courtroom during the sentencing.
I lost it. I mean, I didn't expect to be as emotional as I was, but I just broke down. I was shaking with anger. I was disgusted at the fact that this was even an option.
Then to the war party. We speak to award-winning investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill about how U.S. militarism is the great unifier from Bush to Obama and Trump to Biden.
All discussions about China, all discussions about Russia regarding U.S. policy leave out the role that the United States plays in destabilizing the world, but also provoking responses from other nations.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Charlottesville, Virginia, found the organizers of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally liable for the event's violence, awarding nine plaintiffs $26 million in damages. Convicted murderer James Fields, who is already serving multiple life sentences for killing activist Heather Heyer when he rammed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, was found liable for $12 million in punitive damages. The 12 defendants included three other high-profile white supremacist figures, former leader of the alt-right movement Richard Spencer, event organizer Jason Kessler, and neo-Nazi podcast host Christopher Cantwell. Defendants have been ordered to pay plaintiffs $500,000 each, and five white nationalist groups were ordered to pay $1 million each. The jury, however, was deadlocked on two federal conspiracy charges. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection issued subpoenas Tuesday to far-right groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. Both groups are believed to be involved in planning and taking part in the deadly attack. Dozens of people affiliated with the white supremacist organizations have been indicted by the Justice Department and a federal grand jury. In Georgia, jury deliberations continue today in the trial of three white men who chased down and killed 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who was out for a jog. The prosecution offered its closing arguments on Tuesday ahead of jury deliberation.
They started it. They do not get to claim self-defense. And then, of course, provocation. You can't force someone to defend themselves against you, so you get to claim self-defense. This isn't the Wild West.
Outside the courthouse, Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, struck a hopeful note.
I do think that we will come back with a guilty verdict. And I want to leave you with this. God has brought us this far, and he's not going to fail us now.
Amen.
We will get justice for Ahmaud.
We'll have more on both this case and the Unite the Right verdict after headlines with journalist Nicole Lewis. In Missouri, Kevin Strickland, an African-American man who was wrongfully convicted of a triple murder in 1979 by an all-white jury, has been exonerated and released from prison after over